The sun shall never set on so glorious a human achievement. Let freedom reign. God bless Africa.
I am an African. I owe my being to the hills and the valleys, the mountains and the glades, the rivers, the deserts, the trees, the flowers, the seas, and the ever-changing seasons that define the face of our native land.
There is a place for all South Africans, black and white. It is a partnership.
This is now the time where we should honor the memory of Nelson Mandela to build a new, better South Africa for all our people. Now is the time.
Honorable Chairperson, I was taught when I was very young that insults are the last refuge of a scoundrel. And so calling me a terrorist, friend of Hamas, etc., is like water off a duck's back because it's an absolute untruth and is a mere insult of a scoundrel who has run out of ideas.
Her name is Dr. Grace Naledi Mandisa Pando, who served as the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation until 2024 before the general elections. She also served as a Member of Parliament for the ANC since 1994. In this episode, my colleague and Times Live digital politics editor Lizeka Tandwa spoke to the minister, reflecting back on the 30 years of democracy.
Dr. Naledi Pando, thank you for gracing us with your presence here at the Sunday Times, Times Live, 30 Years of Democracy podcast. I think the starting point is the final chapter, is the starting point is where to from now? I remember when most of us heard that you were not part of the ANC list to Parliament, we're all up in arms because you are, whether you want to admit it or not, but you are the creme de la creme of the ANC's deployees in government. What happens now? Do you still serve the nation? In what capacity do you serve?
Well, I am on the ANC list. I'm on the list of members for Parliament. But I think that's probably old history now. Mm. Because life is proving very interesting. I'm really taking a bit of a break for now. But what I'm doing is I am speaking on issues of human rights and peace and security. I'm inundated with invitations, and I'm really selecting very carefully those that I would take on. Mm. So I've sort of framed my future interaction into a focus on gender empowerment, women's empowerment particularly, education, which is one of my main loves, and human rights, and then peace and security in Africa especially. Mm. Those four areas are going to form the subject of work that I will take on from now on. So I'm proceeding in the next week to Malaysia, where I'll be speaking on the issue of human rights and Islam. And then following that, I'll be participating in a conference on international education, and I will be speaking on internationalizing education in the South African post-apartheid context and what that has meant. And then from there, I've been invited to Columbia University, again on human rights and politics in the United States of America, and the comparative of the Palestine context with the history of struggle in South Africa. So it's I've got a long list of activities, lots of writing, lots of thinking through important concepts, and really remaining, you know, on the world stage, active on these issues.
I'm very glad to hear that. But I think when I look at your resume, especially in politics, you know, from being an educator, a young educator in London, to coming back to South Africa, assuming your role in Parliament as the Deputy Chief Whip, all the way to being International Relations Minister, what is the most impactful role do you think you've assumed in your lifetime career?
Probably education, I would think. You know, many people don't know that the National Student Financial Aid Scheme began as a trust called the Tertiary Education Fund for South Africa, or TEFSA.
TEFSA, yes.
I was a member of the first board of TEFSA, and we are the ones who conceived of the funding for young black students with the partial bursary, partial loan idea. And my dream at the time was that this will become a big national scheme. We began with R1 million in 1992, and look at where we are today in billions. My happiest moment was when our second Minister of Education in a free South Africa, Professor Kada Asmal, introduced the legislation to establish the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, and so to convert TEFSA to NSFAS. So I feel, having been in TEFSA and argued for a larger national scheme, that this is one of the outcomes you know, of my role in education.
When you think of education today, we've got a young minister who's taken up that role in the government of national unity. When you think of education today, where it is now, what comes to mind? What do you think are the pitfalls? What do you think are the necessary areas of concern to you? And where have we excelled in making sure that education is aligned to everyone, encompasses, because we had Bantu education for quite some time in the apartheid era. What are the gains, and where do we need to still achieve?
I can write a whole thesis on this. So I think that we have made a tremendous progress as South Africa, but given our history, there are many, many challenges still. For me, the biggest success is the reality that we have near universal access to schooling for the children of South Africa, and that we've achieved this in the first decade of freedom. This is extremely important. Many countries take many, many years to get to where we went from the beginning, because you will recall that President Mandela, when he made his first policy speech as president of a democratic South Africa, indicated 10 years of compulsory education for all children as the policy of the new government. And for us to have actually pursued that and achieved it, I think is really significant for our country. Our key issue is, of course, the quality of what we offer. And I think given the impact of Bantu education on our aspiration for excellence, aspiration for quality, it is not surprising that really the pursuit of quality will be the long-term endeavor of education. Nonetheless, we do have pockets of excellence, and we need to appreciate that. I am one of the people in our country who believes we focus too much on the negative and inadequately on the progress. And if you lift out the progress, you change the consciousness of a nation toward seeking excellence. So I think we need to address, you know, our mind and how we view ourselves. Then we'll aspire for something different. I also believe in higher education, we've made incredible progress. To have six of our universities ranked among the top 100 of the world, this is fantastic. Given, you know, the extension of Higher Education of Universities Act, which was passed by the apartheid state to curb excellence in higher education, and particularly Black access. One of the big moments for me was in 2014, please excuse me, when we achieved a majority of PhD graduates being Black people. This again signaled a major advance for our country. So as I said, you know, I could go on and on. But I think the biggest problem and worry for me is that education remains a contested space. It shouldn't. Mm-hmm. Education is the site where your country advances. And if it is contested, it's going to be very difficult to really gain the level of success that you desire. So I hope that the new ministers, both higher education as well as basic education, are going to try to get national consensus on what we need to do and get everybody, communities, parents, educators, academics, students, behind the enterprise of achieving quality and excellence in education.
I think of the correlation in your time when you were a student activist in Botswana to the student activism that happened, I think it was 2017, the Freeze Must Fall movement. What was going through your mind during that time? Was it reminiscent of your own activism? And did you think that it was a movement that had credibility and that the students really had a reason to cry out to government?
Well, the nature of struggle has changed over time, mm-hmm. obviously. And I found aspects of how the students waged their protest really troubling for our society, particularly aspects of violence, forcing others to join in and that sort of thing. But the objective was an important objective, and I think it was necessary that the voices of students are heard. Where I was concerned was that there didn't appear to be clarity as to who the beneficiaries of this free education should be. South Africa is a country with vast disparities in terms of wealth and income status. And for everyone to have free education seemed to me not to recognize the nature of inequality in our country. There are those who can pay and who should pay, and there are those who totally cannot afford and yet have the talent to access a higher education. So the absence of that distinction made the call too subjective for me. Mm. I believed it needed some insertion of this complexity of an unequal society.
Mm. I want to now move towards your years in cabinet, Ma. You were a minister of higher education, you were a minister of education, minister of home affairs, international relations, and so forth. There was a time, and I know you don't want to dwell in the negative, but there was a time, those 10 years, some people will say, sorry, the 9 years, some people will say the 9 wasted years. When you think about those years, do you agree? Was it really a wasted time? Were there any accomplishments, do you think, that were not necessarily given the right profile?
I'm always worried about the terminology, you know, that we use. I think in those 9 years, there was terrible corruption in our country. There was also the state capture and so on. But government continued to function in various sectors. But the level of abuse was really problematic. And some of us were fighting against that. We don't go and, you know, write in the papers about ourselves. But we tried to keep probity and integrity in the work that we did. But yes, I do think we went through a really awful period where there was a lot of thievery of public resources and more interest in lining the pockets of certain individuals in business, because we shouldn't forget the role of the private sector, as well as some politicians.
Was there ever a time where you wanted to give up? Was there ever a time where you felt you could not stay any longer in that position?
No, because I thought if I go out, it's going to get worse. Mm. So I had to do my work, protect the resources I had responsibility for. I also, you know, as an African, I have an appreciation of the notion of community. Mm. But as a person brought up in a particular way, I believe individuals have responsibility for their ethics and integrity. So I don't appropriate the fault of all people, nor do I insert myself, you know, in a group that is doing. So I believed I have responsibility for this 6 billion in Home Affairs. I must ensure that it is utilized in terms of the law and utilized in service of the people. And that's how I've conducted myself. Now, it might be a fault in that I don't join groups and say, you know, let's do something together. But I was brought up that I must have ethics, I should have responsibility, and I must conduct myself with integrity. And wherever I've been, I can tick that I've tried to do that.
And that integrity has shown, Ma, in that I don't think anyone in South Africa, white, black, Indian, or coloured, whatever colour or race, can fault you in terms of how you've conducted yourself in government. What sustained you in terms of your integrity, your morals, your ethics in government when so many people were faltering?
Well, it's my family. Mm-hmm. I don't want the name of the family to be reflected in a terrible way in public media or any other form of media. I have a responsibility to my country, to the people of my country, but most particularly to where I come from, to my family. And I would be deeply ashamed if the name of my family, either Matthews or Pando, were associated with anything negative. And this was always my fear, is that never, don't allow that, ever. You know, even if there were to be some form of a temptation. And fortunately, depending on how you conduct yourself, people come to realize. And so they won't come and talk nonsense to you. They might try once, but they soon get it that, hey, you know, with this one, sorry, just forget it.
Mm. The women's agenda, I remember an impromptu doorstop with you in 2019 in Parliament where you were talking. You've always punted the women's agenda, making sure that women are represented not only in Parliament but in government and in other forms of governance, as well as in the private sector. How far has the women's agenda gone in the 30 years of our democracy? Are you happy with where we are?
We've made progress, but there's much more to be done. We're not yet where we should be. I think it was wonderful that in President Ramaphosa's first term, cabinet reached 50% female. This was really great, but of course we're 51% of society. But the fact that we were 50-50 was important. But I know that in many sectors, we've not yet seen the progress we'd like to see. For example, among academics, especially leadership in higher education, I think there's a great deal of work that we need to do to have more women vice chancellors leading our institutions of higher learning and leading research as well. So there's a great deal of work. We've got to end violence against women. This, I believe, is the biggest blight on our society, how we change the attitude of men toward us and also the attitudes of South Africans to violence. You know, the statistics on murder, on robberies, cash in transit heists. And, you know, if you live on, you know, your own property, you're worried all the time. You know, what's going to happen? What's, you know, am I safe and so on? It shouldn't be like that. So I think there's a great deal of work that we need to do to just change our society's attitude toward women and ensure that our laws as well as our practices support women. You were talking before we began the program about former Minister Dlamini Zuma. She and myself are members of an organization called IWF SA, the International Women's Forum, South Africa branch. Mam Zanele Mbeki is the patron of IFSA, as we call it. And that organization, when we established a branch in South Africa, we decided the empowerment of young women in leadership, into leadership positions, would be a key project of us as the South African branch. So our first president was Bridget Radebe. I became president after her. And all of us were members, many leading women. And there are young women that were supported to take up development programs, particularly through Gibbs at Wits University and other institutions. And this was our effort to contribute to ensuring that young women are provided with the skills and the support to become leaders in their various fields. So this is some of the work that we have done. But even with that plethora of efforts, of which there are many throughout our country, I think the issue of violence against women militates against achieving full equality of women. It's when women are safe in South Africa that we'll know that we've really made progress.
30 years of democracy, Ma, Doctor, when you look at what you envisioned when you were an activist, is this the South Africa you envisioned to a certain degree?
Not entirely, but certainly a huge success and progress. Let me also share work that we did. I was the co-convener of the Bill of Rights subcommittee of the Constitutional Assembly, and we were responsible for writing the Bill of Rights chapter, for drafting it, of the Constitution of South Africa. And largely, the work that we did is the Bill of Rights that you see today. Now, the fact that our people enjoy these human rights and do enjoy them, you know, I was telling a colleague in the US that our people who are poor now have legal aid. They used to go to court without representation, black people, previously. Today we have legal aid paid for by the state, and you go into court and you are represented by a public prosecutor. It's very, very important that we've made those achievements in water, in housing, in health, in a range of areas. So definitely different from the apartheid experience, but not achieve the level of transformation that one had hoped for. And I think it's these missteps that we've made that lead to, I think, the lack of advance and the failures all of us are aware of. We campaign during elections. I was campaigning during this election. And I, you know, much as I love being on the ground, you go to a certain household and, you know, the lady says, "Ah, nguwe ubuyile, ndisakhumbula, ndisela, uthe ndizoba nendlu andinayo, iphi indlu yam?" And, you know, you can't pendula. And you have to say again, "No, sizawufika, izindlu ziyeza, kune project, uceba uthe kune project enjena, njena, nje." So it's that sort of failure. I wish we could upgrade or improve townships into proper suburbs for our people. This is my biggest disappointment, is the living condition of particularly the majority of the black people in our country. I wish we could have done much, much more. So I'm hoping with this current administration that the matter of human settlements is going to be pursued with vigorous energy so that we build new communities that have decent human settlements and that actually live in a condition that makes us proud when we go out to engage with communities.
I will get to the new government, because I do want to hear your views about the new shape of government as it relates to the progress of the country, economic recovery and joblessness.
Okay.
But I want to, because I just remembered something when we were talking about the women's agenda and violence against women, the conditioning of men. And there's something that Gosazana Dlamini Zuma said in an interview, I believe it was a couple months back, where she was talking about the CODESA negotiations and how, as women, they had to go to Utatu Nelson Mandela, the former president, to say that there wasn't adequate representation of women in those negotiations, in those meetings. And that was critical given, like you said, 51% of the country is women. Mm. That conditioning, I mean, even in the time of the struggle, as I'm sure you know, there was a conditioning in terms of women, the role of women versus the role of men.
Mm.
And it's still entrenched in our society. How do we reverse that, where the woman's role is understood? Because even within the ANC, the woman's role, sometimes you feel that the woman's role is not really understood. The strength of the woman's role is not really understood to be what it is, and it's not really the platform that women receive is not what the platform men receive. For instance, I still don't understand why the ANC doesn't talk about a woman president. Yes, we've had talks about Mamungosazana Dlamini, but really, that is as far as it had gone. Mm. How do we change that conditioning, Mam?
Well, we've had Dlamini Zuma, but we've also had Sisulu, who did stand. We had myself nominated. In the end, I declined. I now regret doing that, but anyway.
I did want to go into that as well.
But, but anyway, I do think there's work to be done. Mm-hmm. One of the things I say to young women, don't think the gender struggle is over. You know, just continue. Because there have been victories and people see progress and then they relax. You must never. Mm. Until you've achieved the level of equity that we desire, don't give up on a struggle. It always remains a struggle. So the notion of our luta continua is very important in seeking to achieve gender equity. I also think that one of the things that we need to do is always reflect on what is it exactly that we desire. At the moment, 52%+ of students at university are female. But largely, they're in what we call non-critical fields of study. They're not in engineering. They're not all in the health sciences. So we've got to break, you know, those barriers. And it's really related to its social engineering. Our society has schooled us to think about ourselves in a particular way. And it's a power game as well. You know, men are not going to let go easily. I mean, some of them, you know, they see three women in a room and they start getting nervous, you know. Or when they talk to you, they call you girly. I've had so many men calling me girly, you know, and I have to say very politely, could you just use my name? My name is Naledi. I'm not girly. I'm actually 40 or 50 years old or whatever, you know, I've had to say to the individual. And, you know, when you do that and correct them, then they say, oh, she's very aggressive, isn't she?
Mm.
You know, so a man will not take certain, you know, degradation, but a woman must accept it because our character must be such that we are always accommodating. So these are things we have to resist. And it's something that we've got to teach our daughters as well. You know, is how do you resist, but resist in a way that will give you success? Because if you overfight it, you actually defeat the purpose. So it's a smart approach, I think, to continuing to struggle for gender equity and finding our own way as well as South Africans. I'll never forget in 1991, which was the first conference of the ANC in South Africa, I was in the conference as a delegate of my province, Western Cape, and Tenji Mthintso and others raised this issue of a third of the NEC should be female. Ooh, such an argument ensued, with the main objector to such a proposal being Tera Legota and some other of the leadership. But the women came, you know, they came. And it went on and on and on. We didn't win the day, but the issue was there on the table.
It was placed on the table.
And it was taken very, very seriously. So, you know, men are not going to give way easily. And I think we have to be smart about what we do. So I do think tactics, teaching, you know, tactics is very, very important. How we raise it, you know, in a meeting. And being ready, because when you raise it, you're saying I'm ready to occupy as well. A chap, I complained, there are no women, you know, there aren't enough women around this table. And why is it assumed that a man must be chair? And so a male said, well, then you should chair. And really, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't speaking about myself. So that's another thing that happens, is that if you speak out, you become burdened with actually taking on this. But it's a challenge, not just for women, it's a challenge for men as well. Because what you're talking about is not women's rights. You're talking about human rights. Why must I be treated differently because of my gender? That in itself is discriminatory. I should be treated the same way. Of course, there are differences, biological, physical, which give rise to particular aspects. But these don't mean I can't be a school principal. They don't mean I can't be a vice chancellor. They don't mean I can't be a dean. You know, so all of those that are somewhat constructed notions, they need to be challenged. But who we are in biology or physical is something we live with, and it doesn't mean we are less, we are diminished by those characteristics.
I'm thinking about when you say that there has to be strategy in the way that you approach these things. And I often look at you in a table full of powerful individuals from all over the world, superpowers. And I often wonder if this is intimidating to you. You are seated next to Mr. Lavrov, you're seated next to Mr. Blinken and so many others. Has there ever been as a female in that position, like you've said, that there is an attitude that comes with how they handle women in those positions? Have you ever been felt intimidated?
Once or twice, yes. For example, I don't like alcohol and smoking, and they smoke and they drink. And, you know, with smoking, I'm very clear. So I will tell my best friend, who's a very powerful minister, sorry, not on this table, you know. But the intimidation would be things like arguments about issues, and they're more experienced than you are. You're trying to speak for Africa, and they kind of, you know, poo-poo what you say. You've got to, you know, stand up and really take on the issues. Other things are, I think while you might not be intimidated, sometimes the officials are. So one time, there was an issue with a very strong country, and I was told they will never agree to the position we had as South Africa. And that, you know, if I raised it publicly, I would affect the relationship between our two countries. So then I saw the minister standing somewhere on his own, and I told my official, I'm going to raise it with him, because I think even if we have disagreement, it's important that I've put our country's position forward, and I seek to get his understanding, because he himself comes from a very powerful country, and he won't just allow his country to be ridden over roughshod. So I went over to him, and I said, I need to speak to you confidentially. And because he speaks another language, I knew he could speak English, but he pretends that he doesn't. And so then he said, no, he needs to have an interpreter with him. I said, that's fine. So I said, it's a very delicate matter, but it's fine. I said, it concerns my country and our policy on a particular issue, and I know you're interested in having our support, but I wish to indicate to you that we would not be able, for a range of reasons, and I set those out, we would not be able to support you. To my amazement, he said, I totally understand. Countries do have different positions, but I know South Africa is a friend and that there will be other occasions, but all I ask, could you do it in this way and not, in a... fine. As long as I'm not betraying my country's standpoint, I'll approach it, as diplomatically as possible. So, I stood up. I was nervous, I can tell you, because it's a big partner. But the reception I got and the friendship we've enjoyed since then indicated to me that when it's an issue of principle, don't back down too easily, be nervous, be afraid, approach it properly, but don't just give up and say, yo, mantule.
In every time that you would stand up on a podium during your time as International Relations Minister and Cooperation, you would talk about multilateralism. You would talk about reforms in terms of the United Nations. From where you were starting on to where we are now, do you think there's been any progress, and what has that progress looked like?
Well, there are ongoing discussions about UN reform, so I think, yes, there's that, but it's been going on for too long. I think we now have to be definitive, and I hope Minister Lamola will be part of that concrete definition of what we mean. On multilateralism, I think, yes, much more embrace of our notion that we don't want unipolarity. We want a multipolar world, and we believe that the premier multilateral institution is the United Nations. Some countries have tried to reduce the stature of the United Nations by denying it funding or insisting that it takes up particular perspectives on global issues. We believe that the UN should be supported because we have an equal voice within it. We're not equally economically, but in terms of exercising your right to speak, voting on issues, we have that presence through the Charter. Where the inadequacy arises and where the key reform must happen is the Security Council. It's unrepresentative, it's undemocratic, it's inefficient, and it's not been able to uphold peace and security. So we just need a real refresh and a real rethink of its role. And really, there's nothing better than democracy, right? When you make decisions, if we are sovereign nations that are equal, as the UN Charter says, why should 15 countries be the ones that decide on these matters? Can't we find another way? And I believe that that we can. But I leave it to the policymakers to continue the deliberations.
When I look at, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, when I look at the time that you were the Minister of International Relations with the President, it is the time where South Africa almost came back to its form, reassumed its position, not only in the continent, but in the world. Your voice was much more pronounced. Was this a concerted effort between the two of you to ensure that when it comes to geopolitics, South Africa has got to stamp its foot, and South Africa has got to be realized as a true power player in the continent?
Well, firstly, I think I was very fortunate to have a president who was interested in international policy and who supported me fully with my work. And that doesn't always happen with presidents and foreign ministers, foreign affairs ministers. So I was really lucky. But also, I don't discount just fortuitous events, you know, that gave us an opportunity. And it, I think the stature relates to how South Africa responded. So, for example, I wrote, you know, with the team in the department, this lovely concept paper on our role as chair of the African Union. We were all ready, right? And very excited that we're going to be chair. We're going to have this theme. We're going to do these things. We're going to have these workshops and so on. Well, what happened? COVID-19, right? So do we sit back and say, wow, we can't mix any longer. We're unable to meet. Let's not do it. No, we said, no. We've got to respond as the continent to this. Everybody was talking about how much harm there's going to be on these poor Africans. Mm. You'll recall even one famous person said, we'll be dying on the pavements and our bodies. You know, we said, no, we've got to help the continent. President Ramaphosa, our department, the health department, our government, framed a response that we tabled to the leaders in the African Union, and we agreed on a coherent, coordinated African response to COVID-19. And that, I believe, saved many, many lives. We did a great deal to get vaccines into Africa, but into the South as well. We got the first vaccines into the Caribbean. And it was through our efforts. So I'm saying fortune created the circumstances where our mettle was tested. Mm. And, you know, the Almighty being there, we responded, I think, very, very positively. So a whole slew of global affairs created conditions that made foreign policy very prominent. And South Africa, I think, responded very, very positively and well.
But one might say you were also up to the task. I want to delve into your relationship with the president, because even before you became foreign minister, the president had identified you as a person who would be his running mate in the ANC elective conference. What exactly is the relationship between you? How far does it go, the relationship between you, Doctor, and the president?
Well, I first got to know His Excellency the President during the negotiations for our interim constitution, eventually the elections, and then in the Constitutional Assembly as our chair. And he was known as a key problem solver and would come up, you know, with solutions. We would run to him and say, hey, this, you know, this wording is not working, or that clause. And he would always, in a gentle, thoughtful way, help to find a resolution. So we've, you know, had that link to him. Very sharp person, always keen to discuss. And in the presidency, for me, what was unusual, I never spent much time with presidents. I just got on with my job. With international relations, you have a very close relationship with the president and his office. And he was always open. We could always meet wherever he was, and he would offer advice. So we had a really good relationship. And, you know, we had many moments of laughter, many moments of dismay, many moments of horror. But throughout, I really benefited from a very good working relationship.
You're not talking about whether ever in many moments where you would sit and debate and argue and disagree on a point.
There were times I said, no, I don't think we should go that way, you know. He would say, no, I want it like that, some little missteps with respect to Russia, Ukraine. Mm. But we'd always find a way of addressing the key issues. I've been really lucky, and I always say, gosh, you know, if I'd had a different sort of person, I don't think we'd have been able to do the many, many things that we did.
I then will ask just briefly, Ma, your decision to decline being the deputy president. Why? You did us a disservice.
I think it was bad advice from certain comrades. I suspect, you know, some people just, yeah. I'm a doer, you know, and I thought, hey, you know, to be deputy president, you just, you know, in the office there, I might not be on the ground like I'm used to. I like to grapple with things. So it didn't seem to suit my personality. But in a way, I think I was wrong. I think I should have let it go to voting because there were regions that supported me, and I was wrong to withdraw. I've never withdrawn from anything before. And maybe I was nervous. It was big, and I'm a humble person.
Does it then, sorry, Ma, to interject, I just thought imposter syndrome that women have. Do you think that was part of it?
I don't know. No, okay. No, I wouldn't not, say. Not, I don't think that. So. But I think it's just me and my character. Mm. And really what I like doing, which is work, and maybe my perception of a deputy president was different. Mm. Yeah. But I do regret it, I must say, you know, looking back. And at the conference, after it was indicated I had declined, a gentleman, comrade, let me say, a member, came in the way, shouted at me. We came here ready to vote for you. How dare you, you know, I'm not going to vote for you for anything. You are shouting at me. Anyway, yeah.
In the president's reaction, was it the same? Not disappointed?
No, I don't think so. He I think, understood. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
I want to talk about Africa, Doctor. When I don't know whether to call you Doctor or Ma'am. Please,
Doctor. Anything, as long as you don't swear at me.
African Union. You know, one might say that the African Union's authority and position has diminished over the years, and one might say that South Africa's position in the African Union as the leader, the big brother. I know that the big brother is often a connotation that is negative, but we've always assumed that position of being the leader. It has diminished in the African Union. Do you think that is incorrect? I say this in terms of the African Union the Morocco coming back to the African Union. That's something we were against, but clearly we didn't have enough of a voice. We maybe not lobbied enough to ensure that that doesn't happen, given what is going on and how it's occupying Western Sahara. Is African Union still a vehicle to bring peace and stability in the continent?
I hope so. Mm. I don't know what you're going to report and what's going to be public from here. Mm. But I do think that we need to think about how we can engage Morocco. Okay. See, because when you are trying to support a people to achieve freedom, those who are oppressing them are part of the parties you must talk to. And I think we haven't quite handled the engagement with Morocco well in terms of being able to say to them, listen, these are our concerns. And from our own experience, we think these can be resolved in the following way. So you don't win it by putting someone totally beyond your ability to speak to them. So I do worry about that, much as I've been part of it.
Mm.
That thing I was talking about of strategy and tactics, that maybe there needs to be a relook at how we may advance both discussion with them, but also the cause of the Sahrawi, because the Sahrawi will gain their freedom when the Moroccans realize that self-determination is important. Mm. So that's one. Then on the African Union, I think that changing Africa is a very complex task. And I'm not sure that we've always chosen a leadership that fully understands the range of matters that must be addressed if we are to see advances. I think the African Union has become a very big, expensive institution which largely appears to focus on administrative rather than programmatic and policy matters, and utilizes huge amounts of resources for employing thousands of people. But when you actually start to investigate the nature of development projects, you don't get the solid answers as to what's being done. What AU should have really focused upon is peace and security on the continent, because conflict is our major problem, but also they should have given far greater support to AUDA and NEPAD, because NEPAD was our institutional vehicle for advancing our development agenda. So I do believe that the AU hasn't focused on this issue of development and on peace and security sufficiently. And I hope with the new leadership that will be elected next year, that they will have a stronger attention to, you know, a new focus that addresses the key problematique of the continent.
I realize,
but I don't think South Africa is unimportant.
Yes,
in the AU. I think that would be a mistake to believe that. We've been serving on the Peace and Security Council, and I think have advanced issues of peace and security very, very well. Also on the African continent, we've been a major contributor to combating the extremist group in Cabo Delgado in Mozambique. We've also made a contribution to the conflict resolution in the DRC, and we've been supporting South Sudan in implementing the comprehensive peace agreement. So we are involved in a range of matters on the continent. We also, of course, helped Ethiopia and the TPLF to arrive at the Pretoria Agreement. So South Africa is not irrelevant, and it's not a small player.
Mm.
We also currently chair of the NEPAD Committee of Heads of State and are advancing development priorities in that context. We've also, of course, had Professor Eddie Maloka as the CEO of the APRM, and he's done amazing work to have over 40 countries agree to be peer-reviewed. This is incredible, because as Africans, we tend to want to be very insular. We don't wish to be investigated. But over 40 countries have gone through the APRM, and several through the second review, just as South Africa has recently done. So I don't believe that it's correct to say South Africa doesn't have presence on the in the AU or on the continent.
Mm.
We are the biggest development partner on the continent. Many people don't recognize that. And of course, the private sector of South Africa is making a massive contribution to the economic development of Africa. I was astounded that there are over 200 companies in Ghana employing over 50,000 Ghanaians and contributing to the GDP of Ghana. So don't underplay the critical and important role of our country in Africa.
I see. I think we've got 5 minutes left, Ma, and I don't want to hold you much longer than you need to. But I want to go to SADC then. When we look at the role of SADC, equally, it's the same sort of question about the role of SADC in terms of Mozambique. Mozambique having to go to Rwanda for assistance. Does that mean something? When, for instance, in the Comoros, where the president decides to forego the constitution and run his own elections. What does it say about SADC?
Well, I think it's worrying that so many countries are acting through their leaders in an unconstitutional manner, and we've got to work hard at entrenching democracy on the African continent. And thank goodness that our country, South Africa, stands out as an example. And I think we must use that example to influence others. This is why it was so important that we had so many African leaders attend the inauguration. So they have an appreciation of what democracy looks like. And it's, you know, something we continue to struggle at. And by the way, we're not perfect, as you said earlier. We have our own problems. But, you know, thank goodness we don't have coups and the military trying to become politicians. It's something we need to stop on the African continent. There are aspects that are very disappointing. Having five coups last year was, you know, a real shock for many of us, because we thought we'd overcome that period of Africa's history. But it means there's more work. And it comes back to what I said about building quality human settlements. Mm. If you don't change people's lives, the people don't believe in you. And so what we've got to do in Africa as well, we must have good governance in all African countries. We must provide services to our people through public revenue. We must create opportunities for young people. We must advance women. So when people begin to see democracy as change, they will never allow a soldier to occupy a political office.
I have two last questions to ask you, and I think maybe one is on a lighter note, maybe not, and that's around your relationship with Mr. Blinken and Mr. Lavrov. How are those two relationships? And when you have to negotiate with these two individuals, more specifically in 2023, I imagine that must have been a tough year for you. You had to deal with both Russia and the United States. How is dealing and that strategy and tactics that you were talking about, dealing with finessing that that relationship between those two superpowers?
The relationship with Russia has always been positive. We did have a cooling with the United States Secretary of State, but always cordial toward each other. But I think that they were disappointed with the fact that we would not articulate support for Ukraine. But we indicated we couldn't articulate support, not for Russia, not for Ukraine. We would remain non-aligned. So that did lead, I think, to disquiet. And then, of course, we are total opposites on the question of Palestine. We find what's happened to Palestinian people since October 8, abhorrent. The United States has openly supported Israel on this matter, even to the degree that my colleague said he's Jewish on this matter. And I found that very surprising for a political leader of global stature. But we spoke last week, and we agreed that actually we remain colleagues who would like to be in touch, and that we learned from each other. I think I learned from how he manages the global stage, and he learned from my cheekiness. So, and he said so, you know, that I'm stubborn, you know. And some of the views I hold, he found them educative, he says. So, so you know, there was a cooling, I don't want to lie. But I think South Africa and America will remain good friends. And I asked Minister Lamola that as part of his initial set of agenda items, a visit to the United States would be important.
And your relationship with Mr. Lavrov?
Lavrov, he's scary. But he's a teddy bear, actually.
He looks scary in Western Cape.
He's just, wow, you know. He's the longest serving foreign minister. Him and Wang Yi, I think, of China. But Sergei's got this voice and he's cheeky, and, you know.
I think it's the Russian,
you know,
demeanor.
But he can be an absolute teddy bear. He sends me these beautiful scarves, you know, and every birthday he sends some flowers or something, you know, and he goes, Nalede! It's this gritty voice. But they love South Africa. They wish to work with South Africa. And at times they don't understand why, in their view, they feel we are hesitant, because we have to be attentive to likely European and American sanctions on our country. And so we're not as all in as we may be. And I think they find that a bit troubling from time to time. But nonetheless, we maintain very good relations. And he wrote me a lovely letter when I, you know, left office.
I think the final question is around the Government of National Unity. When at the IEC we're receiving those, they were capturing those votes, and we could see that the ANC is in no way going to make it back as the majority party. I'm sure you had feelings about it. And then you had to realize that you were forced to go into a coalition, and the coalition would form, would necessitate a government of national unity. What do you think of where we are when we are? Some of your comrades will say that the ANC has gone into bed with neoliberals. This is the ANC selling out. The SACP has said this. What do you think of this formation?
I never in my 30 years of being in parliament imagined the ANC would be in a unity with the Democratic Alliance. So I'm still getting used to it. And I'm on a watching brief.
That's all. Thank you, Ma. Thank you so much for your time.